You're seeing all the behind the scenes stuff.
I'm interested.
Now.
I'm getting the sort of DVD extras.
Yeah,
the behind the scenes stuff is Tom can produce audio and Matt can't, so.
And you're very welcome to Beneath Skin, the show about the history of everything told through the history of tattooing. I'm one of your hosts,
started.
Thomas.
We started.
Okay. I'm Thomas O'Mahony, as always, and I'm joined by my esteemed co-host, Dr. Matt Lauder, and we have a third voice on the pod, one that you might be familiar with. Sheffield's second biggest export since steel. We're joined by Dr. Adam McDade. I'm outweighed in this episode with PhDs.
I mean, barely. I barely qualify. But yeah, hello. Hi.
You can't say you barely qualify. I'm the one that partly was involved in qualifying you. So what does that mean?
I don't feel like I'm legit yet. Straight in with the self-deprecation. So yeah. tattooist. Let's go with tattooist.
Tattooist, former academic, and most importantly, friend of the pod. Adam, you've heard last year his talk from the conference that we were at, and we're going to kind of expand on that and other things today. So Adam, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks. Big fan, as you know.
Yeah, I know. Whenever we put up shirts, who is always the first person to buy one? It's always Adam.
Second time also?
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. I was going to wear it, but then I was like, I'm tattooing and it's white, so I can't wear it.
It's fine. Like I, when we got the first ones, I made sure to take two larges for myself because I know I'm going to wear one the whole time and just be completely destroyed. And then I have one nice one. That, like, if I have to wear it to events, stuff like that.
The Visqua white t-shirt.
Yeah. I haven't got one anymore because I gave my one to Dan Gold, who's also listening. Hello, Dan. I hadn't worn it at all. It was brand new and in my bag, ready for me to wear. And it's also, we should also say to listeners that Adam is like the only tattooer who gets up early in the morning. Like it's 8, it's just the second ticks 9 a.m. And there are two 9 a.m.s, or two 9 o'clocks in the day, apparently, I'm learning.
Yeah, I'm glad that we didn't do it last night because I am much better on the morning than afternoon.
You're like me, you're a morning person.
Yeah, I just function better.
Yeah, sometime Matt, in the future, there's a specific guest that we have to interview, which means we have to get up at 4 a.m. to interview them.
Well, I just won't go to bed. That's okay. It's fine.
You're playing the gambit of each ends of being tired.
Yeah, I can do that. So then I'm also getting my excuses in early for why I'm going to be languid.
you'll be okay. But I suppose, for people who may not know and may not have listened to that episode that we put out last year, Adam, you did a pretty comprehensive and very unique piece of research as part of your PhD into researching tattooing, not just as a kind of, you know, an artistic profession, but also as like being a holistic kind of practitioner. Do you want to give people maybe a brief summary of that to begin with?
Yeah. I haven't thought about it for a little while, actually. See if I can remember all the spiel. So it was a practice-based PhD in design. I did it at the University of Sunderland while I was starting my tattoo apprenticeship at 666 Studios. And the nature of the research involved tattoo and practice, so kind of uniquely, as well as autoethnography, to try and uncover some of the content surrounding the role of the tattooist and the process of tattoo production that other disciplinary avenues haven't really had suitable methodological tools to examine in a meaningful way. So it was stuff like what's actually involved on a design level with tattooing, but also what the tattooist's role is both materially and non-materially. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just spent some time mainly through dissection of autoethnography or long-form textual written accounts of tattooing experiences, finding themes that kind of contributed to this this non-material aspect of the role and categorizing them in a way that is representative of multiple practitioners rather than just myself, but like some themes that are kind of universal.
Yeah, so like for those who aren't academically minded, what Adam is saying is trying to understand the role of the tattooist outside of just being like the application and process of a tattoo. And it's something that, you know, I've spoken to a lot of tattoo artists about, and I'm sure the two of you have over the years as well, that like the actual tattooing part of being a tattooist is only about 10% of it, and a large portion of it, outside of all the business aspects and that sort of thing, is the holistic experience and interpersonal experience of being a tattooist.
I think it's really interesting because like the voice of the tattooer, of the practitioner, is almost entirely absent, let's say, from academic writing about tattooing, other than also friend of the pod, Professor Samuel Stewart.
You're up there with Sammy now.
Yeah, well, he is. I've told him that to his face. Tattooing in the 19, you know, he's tattooing in the 1960s and 70s. Who'd had a PhD in English literature before quitting academia to become a tattooer. Like, so that book that Sammy wrote at the end of his career in the 90s, and bear in mind he wasn't a sociologist. He wrote basically a sociology book about tattooing called Bad Boys and Tough Tattoos. And that is probably the only book, other than, there's also a book by a guy called Clinton Sanders called Customizing the Body. But other than those two books, really, there isn't really the voice of the tattoo artist in academic literature per se. But of course, lots of tattooers have been interested in this and have written about it. I mean, Ed Hardy, for example, is the most obvious example, as always. Like, he said in Modern Primitives in 1989, his interview there, like, quite interestingly, that like he found on some level tattooing to be quite like therapy for the client. And I know, well, I think we'll get into that with Adam in a second. But at the same time, he was also trying to push this kind of quite individualist, quite creative, quite kind of artistic idea of what it meant to be a tattooer. So even in, you know, even in Ed Hardy's hands, this metaphor and this relationship between the role of the client, the care of the client, the interest of the client, and the kind of creative input, the autonomy of the artist, is really muddled. And I, what Adam did for the first time, in a long form academic sense at least, is really explore this this kind of complex relationship between the quote unquote artistic intention of the tattooer and the wishes, needs, and kind of experiences of the client. On the other hand, it's a really interesting sort of gap in the literature, to use that word. Although, of course, as you said, Tom, it's something that all tattooers will be familiar with, this the universality of this tension between what you as an artist want and can do, and what your client wants, and what is possible. You know,
yeah, 100%. I think like, what I have recorded is stuff that isn't, you know, like you say, many other tattooists will have this experience. And I've just been in a fortunate position to have, like, an academic institution take me on and allow me to do the research, like, while in a tattoo studio, to record it and kind of formulate a way of presenting it in a way that's communicable of other people's experiences. So it's not like I haven't discovered anything particularly unique. I've just wrote it down in a unique way.
Well, that's it. You've documented something that hasn't been documented. And I think also why it's interesting is that there have been lots of attempts. And maybe this is a good place to start getting into the weeds with this a bit. Like, you have, there have been attempts by sociologists in particular to talk about this. But really, that's been people who aren't tattooers, not tattooed in many cases, going to tattoo shops and going, tell me how you feel. You know, I'm really belittling the sociological method here, but, you know, not by that much. Aside, some of my best friends are sociologists. I always have to say that. But there has been an attempt to do this. There has been a real interest in this, but it's not been something that, you know, hasn't come together until you did your work. So I guess I wonder, like, what you were able to communicate, and you know, discovered is probably too strong, but what you found, like, your perspective contributed that was different from the way that a standard sociologist coming into a tattoo shop and kind of interviewing people would have approached the same question.
Yeah,
it's like this is like you're having a waking dream now. It's your Viva all over again.
I know, it does feel very Viva-esque.
I was
the external examiner for Adam's thesis, so he's probably having a...
That's why it's particularly familiar, yeah. I haven't read it as recently as I...
I guess the question is, what is it that an artist sees about that process that like the rest of us, even customers, don't see?
Yeah, so I think the sociologists who've examined that question using those methods that you've mentioned, being like asking clients like, ooh, what's it like? Or asking tattooists, how is this going? Like, what do you feel like? It's hard to kind of tacitly like know that without first-hand engagement. You need to be doing these things and experience them in order to really like meaningfully understand them. I guess it's that filtering process, going through yourself as a practitioner, but also trying to analytically categorize it. That's like, I suppose, the sociological methods won't, or ethnography at least, doesn't allow for. And that's, like you say, what a lot of the research is. So Clinton Sanders is the person who I cite the most frequently because it was, although Sam Stewart was like, obviously a tattooist, it was a while ago and from a very different perspective, whereas Clinton Sanders was the 90s and it's a little bit more comparable. However, I think he states himself, I'm sure there's a quote somewhere about perceived discomfort in the restraining parameters of sociological analysis or something to effect.
Yeah.
And I think that's like very true, and you know, good on him for recognizing that. And I think that, yeah, just you know when someone says like, how do you drive, and you're like, you just do.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing, and then you have to like just find a unique way to communicate that, I suppose.
And I think, sorry, I thought where you got to that, the way you got to that was really interesting, and again, I think probably the most important part of your approach to begin with was that you started documenting as soon as you started tattooing. Like, it wasn't, you haven't been tattooing for decades and then were reflecting on it. You were keeping a diary of like every tattoo you'd ever done, more or less, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. I think that was really important and kind of serendipitous. I didn't plan it that way. I didn't plan any of it. I didn't plan the PhD. I didn't plan learning to tattoo, which kind of fell into place, but they both fell into place at the same time. And well, actually 5 months before, I think I started to learn to tattoo. I started it in May 2017. I started my PhD in October 2017. But again, none of that was planned. And because I was already in that learning process, and because my background was an academic training in illustration and design, that kind of scholarly approach to learning was ingrained in me. So I adapted that into my apprenticeship and kind of did things like, you know, make a tattoo journal. So every tattoo that I did, I had like a date, a picture, a client name, and I included it as like an appendix in my PhD. Mm-hmm. And as I was learning stuff, both practically and just experientially, I was recording it in like a journalistic form. And I think coming at it from that early stage, like kind of fresh, is advantageous for the reasons that you've mentioned. It's not like, you know, you already know how to do something and it's hard to explain why. You're learning it, and that early bit is really important, I think.
Also, I think one of my big takeaways from your PhD is the understanding of the tattooist role in these kind of three different spaces that you laid out. Would you mind explaining that for people?
Yeah. Is this the non-material aspect?
Yeah,
of it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So like we've talked about the kind of, I think, the experience of both starting to tattoo and becoming a academic, like melded together, because obviously not only are you learning how to do it, you're studying the methodology of it and like analyzing it in a way that, you know, like you said, Matt, like you don't have years of gathered habits, and which, and also, as we're going to talk about the non-material things as well, the way that tattoo artists approach the abstract level of tattooing, both in how they relate to clients, how they relate to themselves, and the experience of tattooing the clients. So do you want to talk about those kind of three areas of non-material aspects that you talked about.
Yeah, yeah. So in the fourth chapter of my thesis, I think it was, I categorized the role of the tattooist into two categories, one being the material, and I like adopted the yin yang symbol. Mm-hmm. So the black bit, which is the yang, which is the visible, so the material in this case, that's like the provision of the medium, so what you think of when you think of,
yeah,
you know, what tattooists do. But the invisible bit, the yin bit, the non-material, that is the provision of service. And then the three categories come into it from there. So I termed those conscious canvas, navigate intention, and person, not just practitioner. So the first one, conscious canvas, is about adjustment in relation to the client. Mm. So the things that we do sort of because the surface that we're working on is sentient. Mm. It's not like so when most of the time.
Yeah. And I suppose to bring it back to your experience, it's not like being a graphic designer and being given a brief and you're working on something that is, it is static in a sense that like once it is made, it like doesn't, like it isn't sentient, it doesn't live, but also it's kind of, it's changeable in the sense of like revisions, whereas like with a tattoo, once you do it, that's the tattoo, yeah, and the person has to live with it.
Yeah, there's the back and forth. So in the design process, often it's done like prior, but there's a back and forth like on the day about size and stuff. So you're adjusting your conduct in relation to the client, but you're also adjusting how you are, because tattooing being such a broad medium, especially in like, you know, the time period that we're in, like I can tattoo on one morning, I can tattoo an 18-year-old getting the first tattoo, and then I can tattoo my friend who I've known for years and they've got like no space left, and then I can tattoo like an elderly person getting the first tattoo from bereavement. That's one medium, different application, same person. So yeah, I've got to adjust my conduct in relation to those various clients.
And I think as well an interesting point is that like even the experience of tattooing the same person over like multiple different tattoos or multiple different sessions also changes as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the relationships kind of expand and change and yeah, just the personified nature of it, I guess.
For those who are academically minded, the control is you.
Yeah, that's true. Sorry, go on, Matt.
Well, can I ask you on that? One of the things, again, I thought was really interesting about not just the work, but about you, Adam, is how honest you were about your anxieties about that, which is also something that tattooers don't talk, at least not to the public, about. I know they talk to each other about it, but this, because you were documenting it and from a position where, you know, as someone just starting out, you were able to sort of say in black and white, so to speak, like, this, what if I fuck this up? Like, I'm worried about this. Yeah. Like, this is a real big kind of real big thing that I'm doing. You know, it's as Hollywood says, it's powerful. And that's something that, you know, I've heard tattooers say, some very, very experienced tattooers say, but it's not something that many of them admit out loud. Is that anxiety related to some of this interpersonal kind of conscious canvas stuff, at least in part, right?
Yeah, yeah, in part for sure. So all of these themes kind of go into each other, but the anxiety, like for me, I feel like within 5 seconds of someone meeting me, they probably pick up on that. When tattooing, like there's nothing to lose in being sort of naked about it and just being like, this is what the experience is. And I think it's important to document that also, because that is, you know, it's not just, I am an anxious person, but that's not like unique to me, especially in 2024. It's not unique to me, but in general with tattooists, it's not unique, you know, like everyone is in those stages. And I think like to report that is really important. Otherwise, you're not accurately conveying what the experience is. And that's what my question was. It was, what's the experience?
Sorry, was part of that anxiety about the responsibility to your conscious canvases, to about the other people?
Yeah, for sure. So like I was saying about those various client types, a few examples that I gave, like someone getting their first tattoo, like they don't know what to expect, and it's not just, you know, fucking it up, it's also like, how am I going to relate to someone who's maybe been bereaved? Like, how am I going to conduct myself in a compassionate and sensitive way that they feel comfortable with, and like make sure that everything around me is not like distracting from their experience? Because if someone's got like Limp Bizkit on in the background and then someone's like working through a lot of stuff, like there's a bit of a clash.
Sometimes you gotta listen to Limp Bizkit and work through some stuff.
Well, you do, but
it's not, you know, the two don't naturally go together.
No, well, that's it, yeah. So it's like trying to navigate amongst that. So yeah, that second theme, navigating tension, that's kind of where that comes into it. All sort of feed into each other in my in my mind, but like...
Very Buddhist of you.
Well, you know, I'm a practitioner. Yeah, so the navigating tension thing is like... So there's tension depending on, like, if you're in a studio, like, you're working... It's like somewhere like 666 has a very good reputation. I'm very fortunate in that, like, the guy who owns it is like one of my best friends. He's like a hero of mine, but he's also like an incredible tattooist. You'll see him in books and stuff.
Yeah.
He came out with this incredible color realism at a time when no one else in the UK, very few people in the world were doing it in the like mid first decade of the 2000s. Early part of that decade. He was one of these like tattooers who came out of nowhere out of the northeast, you know, not in this kind of London scene, and just completely like started publishing stuff in magazines. Everyone was like, who the fuck is this guy? Fucking hell.
An autodidact as well. He taught himself in a garage with some kit that he bought just on like fake skin and stuff, and then was amazing within like a year. He came from he worked in the States, like he made computer games, like Need for Speed and stuff. He like was he developed that.
I didn't know that about him.
Yeah, he worked for Disney as well. So when I was getting tattooed by him when I was like a bit younger, his young daughter at the time, who's now an apprentice, Millie, who's already incredible. He was getting like sketches, like original Disney sketches, sent over for her. And it was like so sweet. But yeah. So there's a lot of gravity on that, you know, because he's such a like a role model to me and like just a great guy. But the studio has this reputation, and I'm there, like filled with all of this stuff, this like anxious stuff, and I'm like, don't fuck this up. So there's tension there, and then there's also like, I don't want to spoil a reputation, but I also like don't want to be like, okay, so I need to charge for this tattoo, but I'm not really happy with it, so I'm going to charge a bit less. But the studio take their cut.
And they're
expecting a certain amount. So there's those dynamics that are involved. But then more to the thing that we were talking about before, the second tension is like, you know, conscious canvas clients are sentient. They each have their own baggage. It's like tattooing as a process. It's intimate. It's durational. It's painful. And social. So you won't necessarily get on with everyone that you tattoo. So you can have conflicts in that instance.
And you're also more than likely going to inevitably have to tattoo things that you don't want to tattoo.
In terms of
like style, design might not necessarily be your bag, but you know, it's one of the few industries where the customer isn't always right, but you can't admit that.
Yeah. There's also that, yeah. But sometimes it's just, yeah, you'll do stuff that you don't think from a design perspective is the best choice. But yeah, it's like, well, it's not my tattoo.
That's been a really interesting, I think, again, something that you bring to the table, Adam, which is a conversation that a lot of tattooers have in a sort of abstract way. Some in good faith, some definitely not in good faith, which is like, I'm an artist. I'm a crafts person. I'm just a tattooer. I think some people kind of wear that as a weird kind of like anti-badge, you know, like, oh, I'm...
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Which I think is really strange. I mean, I understand where it comes from. These distinctions between, you know, as I've talked about at length, like one of the things that I'm quite keen to do is not try and go, tattooing is art because it is good. Yeah. Like, because that's not how...
Because you like it. Yeah.
Yeah, but people who kind of reject... Tattooers who reject the label of artist do so because they reject because they acknowledge this kind of service part of the role, which lots of people, you know, which doesn't have to be in tension with an artistic analysis. I guess. I wanted to ask you a few questions on that. Like, one is like, how do you deal with that as a tattooer? Like, just you personally, and then I don't know how, whether you think it's more universal, like someone coming in and wanting something that you can do, but it's not your favorite, or they want it smaller or bigger than you think is good, or they want it somewhere visible. Like, how do you negotiate that, both in this kind of social level of dealing with the customer, but then also with your own creative, let's not use that word, artistic, creative head on? How do you balance those two things?
Yeah, so just regarding the medium and like the role of the practitioner, I suppose, like I published about this in that book that you contributed an article to, A Medium Not a Phenomenon. What was it called? Tattooed Bodies, that one. And it's about this contingent approach that we take from craftsperson, designer, visual artist, depending on the brief. That's the way that I see it. So I see it like my role materially in like various different examples will change. So if someone's coming in and they want, you know, Times New Roman, some Roman numerals, my role is more of a craftsperson because I'm not designing anything. My authorship is less visible. My authorship is apparent in how, like, you know, how I will tattoo. It might be different to everyone else in the studio, but it's very minor, comparable to if someone's like, I want that flash piece that you've designed independent of anything. That's more of a visual artist, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think it's a perfect model, but the most easy one to explain probably to listeners that I think works is R.G. Collingwood's idea from the 1940s, where he says, in summary, like, craft has a fixed endpoint that you are working towards. So a craftsperson has a target and works diligently and you know, skillfully towards that predetermined end, whereas an artist doesn't have an endpoint they're working towards. They just sort of know when it's finished. It's not a perfect analogy, and there's lots of other ways to think about the art craft distinction, but I always liked that one as a quite, you know, when these sort of people online often are saying, "Well, I'm not a tattoo artist. I am a humble tattooer because, you know, I spit on my shoes and whatever." I think the most sort of steel man way to read that, the most charitable way to read what they're trying to get at, and I think it is legitimate, is that they are working within constraints set for them by someone else, which is a real true part of all tattooing, even the most creative, right?
Yeah. But I suppose I agree with that sort of model. I think that is a good sort of overview of it. But I think the difference is if someone is getting, you know, if you're going to a tattooist, if you're going to Scott Move, for example, like, you want a Scott Move piece. Whereas if you go for Roman numerals, you're not really bothered. You just want someone who can do it. So the visibility of authorship is very different in those examples, I would say.
I do remember once reading an interview with Horiyoshi III. I think he's probably changed since, but I can't remember where I read it. But I'm sure he, of, you know, one of the most famous kind of tattooers on the planet, once said, if someone comes to me and asks for a rose, that's what I'll give them. I mean, you'd be sort of mad to do that.
Yeah.
but that comes from that Japanese context as well. But yeah, I think it's interesting.
But I think, like, definitely this, like, navigating tensions is really kind of the point of threading the needle where this intentionality and authorship and these non-material things of the, I suppose, the art of being a tattooist really juts up against the material reality of it as well. It's like the intentionality of the client coming in with a certain set of expectations for designs and experience, and you as the artist then interpreting both your intentionality with the brief, their expectations, and then what is the material outcome going to be at the end on the skin.
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening at once. Mm. Yeah, that's certainly a big one of the tensions. Mm.
And then I suppose getting to the other side of the needle, we've pushed the camel through the eye of the needle. Do you want to talk about that third aspect then?
Yeah, so that's person, not just practitioner. That's what I've termed it, at least. And that, I guess, is, it comes from that navigating tension bit. So if you're, like, you have to adjust your conduct, but you also like if you're talking with someone who is getting this bereavement tattoo, then you're going to, and especially if it's a longer piece, like take, well, even if you're talking through it and it's 30 minutes plus, like you take that home, you know, like it's not necessarily easy to work around. And I know a lot of people do get desensitized to it. And perhaps at the time that I recorded those autoethnographic insights surrounding my experiences of that type of thing, I was newer to it, so less experienced. I don't know, that's still kind of up for examination. But today still, like if I'm tattooing someone and I relate to them in any significant way, like it can impact you. So I wrote in my PhD how, like, after doing a tattoo like that, after doing a tattoo that I wasn't particularly happy with, and it was also bereavement one, I went home and just burst into tears as soon as I saw my partner. Like, I was just really, like, you know, upset about it, because not only is it like a permanent medium, it's like it for them, it, there's a embedded meaning, or like, you know, something that it's representative of, and that's heavy, you know. And then on the converse of that, I suppose, like, you also can make friendships through it. So like one of my best friends in Manchester, I met him through tattooing him. He's a yoga teacher, and I started going to his classes, and now, like, we meet up regularly. So can happen in, you know, in both those ways. Do you
think that's, do you think that real kind of empathetic experience, I mean, I think part of me thinks all tattooers, certainly the ones that stick in the industry, have to have some degree of empathy, you know, because I think one of the things that burns people out, it seems, is having to not really, I mean, the physical side of tattooing is obviously very difficult and can be damaging on your body. But I think from people that, like, quit the industry, I think it's that interpersonal stuff that's the hardest. But I wonder if you think that your experience, how typical you think your experiences are there, Adam, because I've taken, you know, I sort of read a lot of the subreddits now, like there's like tattoo advice and shitty tattoos, and lots of the people on there who've either had bad tattoos or are asking questions, often their questions are about where this mismatch from the client's point of view hasn't worked out. And sometimes they're clearly very unreasonable, the clients, and sometimes they've got a point. And, you know, it seems to me that actually, I mean, there obviously are still terrible tattooers out there, but in an era where there are more technically good tattoo artists than ever before, it's this interpersonal stuff that's causing more of the problem for people online, you know, asking questions and worrying about it. So I wonder if you think, like, most tattooers or most good tattooers or whatever approach the gravity of something like a bereavement tattoo in the same way that you do, or do you think that I'm sure there are many others who go, look, I've just, you know, this for me as an artist, as a tattooer, is quote unquote just a tattoo, and I don't want or need to hear the story behind it. I don't want to get involved with it because that makes my life harder. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, so I think it kind of goes back to your thesis, the idea, you know, it's a medium, and the practitioners who use that medium are so varied because the landscape is so varied. Like, tattooists aren't one type of person, and tattooing styles are, like, so varied also. So practitioners will have different ways of working, and clients will have different expectations depending on how they've been exposed to it, I believe. So, like, post-2005, so post-Miami Ink tattooing, where there's a narrative aspect of it, like, that's a massive part of the popularization, from what I understand, of people having this expectation of...
You know, Michael Atkinson says people learned... Michael Atkinson, really nice sociological book about tattooing called The Sociological Imagination, which is... pretty decent Canadian guy. Anyway, in that book, he basically says the one thing I always remember and take away from that book is he says that people learned from tattoo magazines and from Miami Ink to think about tattooing in that narrative way. And that now becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that they want and for actually sure. Then need, not just want, but need to tell you why they're getting tattooed, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's like, if people have been exposed to tattooing through content like that, then or TikTok or something like that, then that's what they'll come to expect. So if someone's been in the industry for, like, you know, 10 years plus, they're probably going to be like, I wasn't around, I wasn't learning that stuff. Like, this, well, not 10, but like, well, pre-2005. Like, they're going to be like, this is sort of a new expectation, or at least a more recently common expectation, this sort of delivery of service in this particular manner. Yeah, so I think I don't think there is a right way. I think it's varied, you know. I think, like, if I was a client, I would pick a tattooist that I know aligns with, like, what my values are. And if I was a tattooist, I am a tattooist, but, like, I'd try my best to adapt to meet the client's needs. But that doesn't mean that every tattooist should. That's just how I would approach it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think as well, like, there's, and I talk about this quite often as well, that, like, I wonder how much the fact that now, like, I think, as an addendum to, you know, Matt's thesis of it's a medium, not a phenomenon, I also think of it as, like, there are two sections of it, as a medium and as a community. And I think the aspect of now that so much of people's interactions with tattooing is through, you know, platform mediated communication. You know, you're talking to an artist on Instagram for a while. The first time you probably meet them is when you go into the studio to get the tattoo. And that kind of, I wonder how that affects the interpersonal relationship between the person getting the tattoo and the tattoo artist. Because it's like, how do you interpret someone's expectations when you have only just exchanged a few messages, done like a booking form, that sort of thing, when in reality, and I think, you know, one thing that I really admire about you is that, like, you seem like a, like, deeply and endlessly, like, compassionate and empathetic tattooist, and your approach to it is so considered of the person at the end of the process. Like, how do you, like, navigate that? Because you can gauge, I feel like, so much of someone's expectations when you are in the room with them having that conversation.
Yeah. So for me, if someone at work jokes that, like, I'll turn down a tattoo if the vibe's off. Like, yep. If someone comes in and they just have an energy that I don't feel like I can really meet, mm-hmm. And someone else is available to do a walk-in, for example, yep. I'll be like, I'll do it if necessary, like, because I don't want to, again, there's that tension to do with studio making money. They take a percentage. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, like, you know, do a disservice to the studio. But if someone else is more able to, like, more mm-hmm. willing to take it on, then they do that. However, for myself, like, it's, if someone's getting custom work or flash work, I mainly do flash work in Manchester, which is amazing because people are weird and they like weird stuff, and that's what I do. So if someone's, like, getting flash or custom in the style that I do, then, like, I've never not got on with someone. Mm-hmm. I've never not had a really good time with someone I've tattooed my own stuff on.
The art in and of itself is kind of a filter for someone. You know, Sammy Stewart didn't tell Sonny Barger to piss off because his vibes were off, you know?
Yeah. It's a very different experience.
Quite the opposite, I think. Listen to that episode if you've not listened to that episode, patrons. I mean, I wonder if, like, on that as well, it's also something that comes up a lot on those tattoo inquiry subreddits, is people who end up with bad tattoos or tattoos they don't like because they couldn't, they were, you know, too anxious, too nervous to actually tell the tattooist, no, I don't want that, I want it differently, where the artist, you know, and again, it's hard to tell through the, you know, through the storytelling with one side of the story exactly who's at fault. But, like, there are certainly stories of tattooers, you know, I know there's people that I know, I'm sure we all know people, who the tattooer has railroaded them into something in the moment, either a size or a color or a something specific that wasn't what they came in wanting. And then the client afterwards didn't like that. Or on the other hand, the tattooer was acting in good faith and produced something based on the brief. And I know that's an impossible job. I want to talk about that with you as well in a second, about how you work with client briefs. But when someone comes in and doesn't really communicate what they don't want, and then they feel kind of aggrieved because they weren't able to communicate. I mean, how have you been able to sort of learn to navigate those things? So that the client who can't explain to you what they want or what they're happy or unhappy with, like, it's a very difficult process, right?
I think it's you have to know how to read people. I came to tattooing a bit later. Like, I started at 27, like age 27. And prior to that, I'd worked in academic teaching and other jobs. And acquired, I guess, skills in picking up on people's demeanor and knowing if someone is, like, you know, saying they're comfortable with something but not, and then interrogating that a little bit in a, like, for the benefit of them, if you know what I mean. So if someone is like, if you're showing someone a size and like, yeah, I'll go with that, I'm like, are you sure? Giving them opportunities to, like, you know, be 100% honest, I think is really important.
But also as well, I think figuring out how to pose those questions to them in a way that doesn't make them feel put on the spot as well. Because if they're already anxious about saying something, and it's like, well, are you sure about that? It's kind of like, that's okay.
Yeah. So, like, it's the delivery of, like, the language. Not just the words, but the delivery of the words. And I think people do generally pick up on the energy behind them.
Yeah.
I realise that when I speak, I sound like a hippie, but yeah.
Fucking hippies. And it's also the case that sometimes, well, not even sometimes, most of the time, the tattooer does know best, right? When the tattooer says, that needs to be bigger, that needs to be the other way up, that needs to be, you know, X, Y, don't get tattooed on your face, don't get tattooed in your hands.
Like, yeah.
Don't copy someone else's tattoo exactly that you've downloaded off Pinterest. Don't get a raccoon skull when you want a wolf skull, as we said on the thing the other day. Like, A lot of the time, the tattooer is right, because they do know what A, works as a tattoo, and B, what is within their skill set to produce well. And that can be a source of a lot of tension. So,
Certainly.
I mean, again, your process is very empathetic and very kind of receptive to client desire and mood. Like, how do you deal with the fact when, maybe this is the vibes thing, where you say to them, I cannot do, you know, I cannot write, you know, your grandfather's three Victorian names round your finger in cursive, for example, you know, that
so, like, stuff that is, like, just not practically possible, or certainly not within my skill set, I'll just plainly say, like, look, it's not gonna, if it's something like that you've just explained, like, it'll probably drop out or blow out, and it'll look potentially good for, like, a couple of weeks, maybe months,
minutes,
after that.
Yeah.
Depending on what it is. And then after that, like, you know, it's a permanent medium, but its appearance isn't. So, like, you have to kind of get that across.
Some artists, again, we see them online. I don't think I've heard really loads of very reputable people say this, but it's not an uncommon opinion. Like, some people say, look, you're the tattooer, you're this service person, you give the client what they want, kill your ego. If they want 8-point, you know, text on their nose, you should do that. Give them what they want. There are more general versions of that. I mean, the sort of hand, face, public visible tattoo one is a really big and ongoing one. So I wonder how you navigate that, both kind of artistically, practically, emotionally and ethically, like this kind of tension that you've talked about between your own knowledge and desires as an artist, as a practitioner, and your clients who want something.
Yeah, I think each of those examples is nuanced. Like, you have to examine it in a case-by-case manner, really. So if someone is, like, a lot of the tattoos where the clients are perhaps a little bit more fussy on placement and, like, positioning, and, you know, you have to do a stencil 100 times, like, they're often on people who aren't very tattooed. And often the distinctions between, say, stencil placement is, like, if they saw them side by side, they'd probably not be able to tell. Like, so you're just doing it because that's what they want, and that's, like, there's nothing really different about its success as a tattoo. It suits what they're after.
I think that's the distinction between the technically impossible versus the, you know, aesthetically, you know, unpleasing, or like those small little minutiae.
I think that's part of the nuance. So, like, communicating that to a client that, like, this will work more successfully as a design, or this won't actually work as a design. Like, it's just conveying that in some way.
And one thing I want
one thing that I'm really interested in, and it's something that you started doing recently as well, is trying to get together yoga for tattoo artists. And it's, you know, talking about the experience of kind of the internal experience of tattoo artists as it relates to their clients. But I think that's something that like people don't talk about, is the relationship of tattoo artists to themselves and their body. And, you know, we all know tattoo artists are, you know, older and are always like, my back hurts, my hands hurt, like my neck hurts. And it's, I think what you are trying to do is really cool, because it's like acknowledging the fact that, like, you know, tattooing is a physically very hard job, and like saying these are things that you can do. And funny enough, talking about TikTok, I saw a TikTok the other day of like two tattoo artists talking about, you know, I'm 40 now, I have to go to the gym just to not be in pain. It's not to be like fit or like look good. It's literally, I've done this for the past 20 years.
I'm like that, and I'm an academic.
Yeah,
that's because you're a neek and you're like bent over looking into books all the time.
Won't someone think about the podcasters?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose yoga's good for everybody, but tattooists do, like you say, like, it's not uncommon to talk about wrist issues, about back issues, because of the positions that you have to get in to get like a good stretch on the skin is like quite impressive sometimes. And I've never had any physical issues because I've always practiced yoga. But a lot of people in the tattoo community, at least where I've worked, which is only two studios, bar guest places, not one of them that I'm aware of is an active practitioner of yoga, and all of them have issues with that stuff. But one other part of it, though, like, yoga isn't just a sauna. Yoga isn't just physical posture. It's just, that's one of the limbs. There's like eight limbs. I'm not going into it because it's not relevant to the podcast. But the tattoo industry is known for ego. It's like, there's a lot of high ego sort of profiles in there, and one of the central aims of yoga is not the depletion of ego, but the quietening of the ego, and not taking the self too seriously. Like, taking yourself seriously where it matters, but no further than that.
Yeah, like, I'm a big advocate of just like physical exercise in general, to, and that meets people's, you know, needs and abilities. And I think that is like really interesting, because I can see the kind of commercialization of tattoo artists' health, as well as like, okay, you could go and like do some, you know, very mild activity that will help, you know, with back strain, hand strain, and this goes for people in general. Or there can be a company that comes along saying like, here's a product that will fix this for you.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, another thing that tattoo artists have to buy.
Yeah.
In order to, one, not be in pain, which is the most important part, but also, as tattooing is a competitive industry, it's to like, oh, to also be, you know, viable within the marketplace, that like, you know, you can do like 5 or 6 tattoos in a day. We're talking performance enhancing drugs for tattoo artists. Doing a Lance Armstrong blood cycling so you can do like 20 spots a day.
Well, that's probably why like people like Jesse Knight, Charlie Bell, and, you know, Cash Cooper used to just go to the pub and get get hammered in between. Or why, you know, Christian Varlick and Martin Hildebrand, you know, had tattoo shops and ran pubs at the same time. Like, tattooers have been getting fucked up for a very long time.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, probably for the same reason that I'm doing yoga ultimately, and that I think it will be beneficial perhaps to others. So the idea that you mentioned, I've applied for funding to produce for free a series of 12 like introductory yoga classes, but like for tattooists, so they come along in an environment where they're not feeling intimidated by, like, you know, active yoga practitioners who maybe know what they're doing, and they're with a familiar person, or someone who's within their community. Then I'm going to illustrate, if I get the funding, a zine that sort of breaks things down, and then people can continue to do it at home. So it's not like a product, it's just like an introduction to some asana and pranayama, which is like breath work that might be beneficial to them, and then they can take that on into further classes if they wish. If not, then they have tools for maintenance, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's interesting because, like, me and Matt both know quite a lot of older tattoo artists. I'm not going to say old because Matt will be like, oh, you calling me old? But I think that, you know, combining those aspects of not just the internal health of the tattoo artist in terms of their mind, but also of their body is super important as well. Matt, do you have any last questions?
Yeah, I had like I had two things. One was, it was a quick thing because it's something again stuck out to me when I read your work, and then maybe a slightly longer thing to finish up on. This first thing is also about this relationship with people. You talked in your thesis about the experience of tattooing someone you didn't enjoy tattooing, and someone who, as you were tattooing them, turned out to be racist, turned out to be quite unpleasant, and how you you weren't kind of there deliberately trying to fuck him up, but you sort of reflected in that moment on how your tattooing practice changed when you realized during a tattoo that you didn't get on with this guy.
Could you talk
about that a bit, and then I want to talk to you a bit about the differences between illustration and tattooing, and then move to a different medium. But yeah, like I think one of the things when I talk about your work, that moment is a real illustrative, if pardon the pun, example of how your thought process works and why your method's so interesting. Because I've not seen a tattooer really reflect on that ever, actually, certainly not in print.
Yeah, I remember at that conference last year, you mentioned your book chapter where it sort of echoes that same sentiment. And I recently, well, not recently, like shortly after that, I read it and I was like, yeah, I get what you say. So the idea was, I was tattooing someone, it was just like he already had this like tribal outline, I think, like 90s sort of tribal. And I was just filling it in black as an apprentice. And I was chatting with him, he was fine, like we didn't really have anything in common, but it wasn't like super awkward or anything. But he'd moved to Sunderland, where I was based, for work, or I can't remember what, maybe a relationship. And he was talking about where he was from, which was Luton, and I was like, oh, do you like it there? Like, do you visit much? And he was like, oh, it's not very good because, in quotes, there's a big Asian problem. And as I was tattooing, like, I went in, like, really, really hard. And I only realized that because he was bleeding a lot. And I was just in response to something he said that I fundamentally, like, disagreed with. And then, yeah, I was like, oh, shit, I'm actually going in, like, you know, I could do some really bad, like, permanent damage here. So I had to pull back a little bit. But I learned that, like, prior to that, I wasn't actually going in deep enough because it was taking longer. And I was like, this is a suitable depth. And I've learned that because this guy's a dick. so it was like a good method in that regard. But then, like, with that whole tension thing, like, he's a client, he's at a studio that has a reputation that will have a Google review perhaps afterwards. I've got to stay in that space and I've got to hold it. So I just continued talking, saying how much I love Asia, how I've traveled there plenty, and like the people are so nice, and like how I can't wait to go back, and made him feel a little bit reflective on the comment that he just made and sense the discomfort and move away from it. And then the rest of the conversation was, again, fine. And it sort of made me think that, like, he's very flawed, but people are complex, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's not as straightforward as this is a arsehole, which it probably is. But, like, at the same time, like, it wasn't completely horrible, but there was horrible aspects, you know?
Yeah.
And that complexity of understanding people, that empathy and compassion, I think definitely is quite a unique thing that tattooing can allow for.
I 100% agree with that. I mean, again, I've been reading a lot of Ed Hardy stuff recently for my new book, and his letters to Sailor Jerry are so interesting, for example, on that same level, because Ed's really reflecting on Jerry's like passion and compassion for tattooing, while also reflecting that he's a racist motherfucker. And Sammy's the same, and like, you know, every tattooer that I know that's been in the game a long time, particularly the people that are in their like 60s, 70s and 80s still tattooing, people like George Bone and Doc Price and stuff. Like, they do have a kind, and I'm thinking of, as you were talking about that kind of like sensitivity and depth, I was reminded of Mr. Sebastian, who very famously tattooed super slowly, and now I'm and also used anesthetic to tattoo, and obviously McDonald also used Southern McDonald back in the 19th century used anesthetic. I'm wondering if there's something about that empathy and compassion that is part of the reason that some of these guys and gals who are tattooing for a long time and rise to the top of their profession really have, that separates them from everyone else, a kind of compassion, a kind of love, not just for tattooing but for other people. I think that's kind of, even if it comes in a slightly misanthropic way, for example, with Sailor Jerry or with Sammy Stewart, you know, who are both horrible misanthropes but also loved people, weirdly.
Yeah, I think it's the appreciation of the complexities of humanity. Like,
yeah, and that's lovely.
Like, it's so broad.
I think that's a perfect place to end, just because Matt, we need to end. So, Adam, where can people find you both online and where to get tattooed by you?
Okay, so I'm based in Manchester at Flesh Tattoo, Flesh on Lloyd Street, not Bridge Street, but you can go to the same place online and find me. My Instagram is Adam McDade Illustration. Will it be like a
it'll be linked in,
yeah,
it as well.
Yeah, you can just go look there. Website adammcdade.weebly.com, and then if you go to my website, you can read my PhD. There's a link somewhere on the about thing, I think. Or if you just type in Adam McDade PhD, I think it comes up on ResearchGate or Academia or something like that.
You should also read it. It's the best piece of academic research in tattooing in the last few years, like by a long way. Like, Adam's is the best PhD on tattooing ever.
That's very kind, Matt.
Matt's trying to say in a roundabout way it's the best piece of research since his. but with,
I'm very flattered, thank you. I appreciate it so much.
With that flattery and those kind words, I also want to say a few kind words to our lovely patrons. Without you, this show isn't possible. So, as always, if you're listening to this, it's on the Patreon, unless you've pirated, which, fair play if you managed to pirate it. But once again, as always, try and do it in one breath. Here we go. Thank you to Stephen McCann, Roy Huxema, Morpheus Ravenna, Chris Block, Charlie Lightning, Baba of Extra, Shit Jesus, Reed Forden, Lupe Calderon, Guernica, Kirsten Wright, Kathleen Burkhardt, James Schick, and Dylan. Thank you to all of our £10 and above patrons.
And also
all of our
thank
patrons.
You to Carly Bauer, who is a listener to this show, who's also doing academic work at the MFA level in the US, who listens to the show. Who has used the show for some of her research, has basically done this amazing little zine thing called Informed Ink, How to Avoid Trauma Scars and Shitty Tattoos. Very kind of much in the vein of what we're talking about here. The real cost of ignorant ink, bad tattoos, allergic reactions, bloodborne pathogens. So anyway, Carly's really great, and she sent me and Tom some stickers and some flyers, and we're very, very grateful. It's very, very cool. And yeah, thank you for enjoying what we're doing, and we enjoy what you do too. So we really appreciate it. She's on, if anyone wants to see her work, she's on at Reckless Magenta on Instagram.
Most importantly, thank you, Adam, for joining us.
No, thank you so much. Such a brilliant conversation. No, I've, as you know, big fan of podcast, and Matt's like an academic hero. So yeah, really flattered. Thank you.
You're my academic hero, Adam. So you know.
Well, we're mutual heroes of each other.
I'm nobody's hero.
And
bye.
Thank you.